Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled, Has Affirmative Action Outlived Its Usefulness? Recorded in 1995, Dennis McQuestion, former clinical professor of corporate governance and executive director of the Institute for Excellence in Corporate Governance at the University of Texas at Dallas, nationally syndicated columnist and professor of economics Walter Williams, president of the University of Texas at Dallas and former president of Howard University, Dr. Franklin Jennifer, plus other guests, discuss whether affirmative action has outlived its usefulness and what should replace it. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Affirmative action, two words which can incite the emotions of most Americans one way or the other. Should we continue to have laws which may result in reverse discrimination, or have they outlived their usefulness? I'm Dennis McQuestion. Join me, syndicated columnist Walter Williams, and others as we debate affirmative action. For 30 years, some Americans have faced the positive and negative consequences of affirmative action. Today, there is a movement afoot, largely pushed by conservatives in Congress, designed to radically change affirmative action. Has affirmative action outlived its usefulness? Stay with us to find out. Magazine cover stories continue to emphasize affirmative action. A recent Newsweek cover story on affirmative action says, it is setting the lights blinking on studio consoles, igniting angry rhetoric in state legislatures, and focusing new attention on the word fairness. Now, when does fairness become reverse discrimination? When is it fair to discriminate on the basis of race or gender? Now, this issue is highly emotional and divisive, but you'll enjoy the experts that we've assembled. I'm going to begin now with nationally syndicated columnist, economics professor Walter Williams. He'll be joining us from our latest affiliate, WNVT in Falls Church, Virginia. Professor Williams, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Good. Welcome to the program. How are things in sunny Washington, D.C.?
Well, thank you. I'm not in Washington. I'm outside the Beltway, so I'm free. I'm part of America.
We're delighted to have you as part of America. Let me ask you this. Has affirmative action outlived its usefulness?
Well, different people mean different things when they say affirmative action. To some people, affirmative action means equal opportunity and non-discrimination. To others, it means hard and fast racial quotas. To others, it means a system of race or sex preferences. Now, the part of affirmative action that means quotas and preferences are offensive to every single concept of justice and fairness. I think that if affirmative action means just non-discrimination and judging people by merits, independent of race and sex and religion and nationality, it is a worthy goal and it is American.
I appreciate that. Now let me ask you, because you are just outside the Beltway, but not by much, why is there so much talk and rhetoric in Washington about trying to do something to eliminate or reduce what is being referred to as affirmative action?
Well, I think a lot of it's unfair. For example, at University of California at Berkeley, each year, 2,000 straight-A white and Asian students are turned away from the admissions process in order to make room for blacks and Hispanics whose academic standards don't come up to these students who are being turned away. And I think that many Americans are dissatisfied with this, and they're putting pressure on Congress. But for black Americans, there's another part of the struggle. That is, affirmative action is disguising and turning our attention away from some real devastating problems. You know, just the whole notion of affirmative action on college campuses, it disguises the fact that the public schools in our cities are engaging in day-to-day destruction of black kids' career chances by giving them fraudulent education. And by fraudulent education, I mean that they are given a diploma that attests that they can read and write and compute at the 12th grade level, when very often, in fact, they can only compute at the 6th and 7th grade level. And by focusing on what colleges are doing, we're letting these schools off the hook.
I appreciate that comment. And to segue, you gave us a perfect segue into our first guest here in the studio. I'd like to introduce you to Dr. Franklin Jennifer. He has served as president of the University of Texas at Dallas since September of 1994. Previously, he was president of Howard University in Washington, D.C., and chancellor of the Massachusetts Board of Regents. He presently serves as chair of the American Council on Education. He's on the board of Texaco Corporation. Dr. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Now, it's interesting that we have Dr. Williams in just outside Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. talking about, hey, maybe we ought to change some of this affirmative action. We have you who spent all this time there. Let me ask you, has affirmative action outlived its usefulness or not?
No, I don't think it has. As a matter of fact, I think what affirmative action has meant for so many people, both minorities and women, has been an opportunity to fully participate in this society. Now, like it or not, we live in a society in which race and gender happen to be very, very serious problems. And race and gender have kept, because of discrimination, have kept women and minorities out of key positions. Something had to be done. And in the wisdom of a variety of legislators and courts, they decided that it was in the best interest of this great country of ours that we include those populations, and it could not be done without some very aggressive action. That aggressive action has been defined as affirmative action, not quotas, but a process to ensure that equal opportunity is a reality in this country and not just rhetoric.
The idea of what we are referring to as affirmative action, that is, and it's all its different forms, you think should continue at this point, or maybe a few changes here and there, but primarily you think the program has done good for a lot of minorities, both women and people of color.
I think that, you know, it has been somewhat exaggerated on who has benefited from it and who hasn't. I think there's some serious problems that still exist in communities in which this doesn't even begin to touch. But in reality, I think we need a very aggressive program in this area. Affirmative action or actions by government to enhance the positions of a population are nothing new in America. And we had the GI Bill, and the GI Bill was a understanding on the part of Americans in Congress that there were people who had served this country well, and it was in the interest of this country to do something positive for them. The same thing exists in a variety of other programs. When we needed engineers, the country decided that they would give engineers a foot up on other populations, and that has been the case for a long, long time. In this particular case, I believe the society, both corporate and public, have made a decision that minorities and women have been kept out, and if this nation is to achieve in a very competitive world, we need to include minorities into that population, and therefore affirmative action has been the law.
Okay, I'm going to ask you the thing about education. I'm going to go back to Dr. Williams in Washington. He alluded to the fact that a lot of people, particularly minorities, are getting pieces of paper that say they are educated when in fact they're not. How would you respond to that?
Dennis?
Go ahead, please.
Dennis, let me say this, that the response to your question, when people, this is an example of the Orwellian news speak. When someone can stand up and say that a system of preferences is the same as equal opportunity, that's just changing the whole the concept of equal opportunity. But going back to your more substantive issue, any black student who would graduate from high school and be able to get 1,000 points on an SAT exam, and 1,000 points is not that much to write home about, he would be admitted on merit to most of United States' 3,500 colleges. But the fact of business is that black students, the average SAT is somewhere around 725 or 750 points. Now, when you focus on what colleges are doing, you just allow the continuation of the destruction by the public school system to continue, and you will need affirmative action and a system of preferences in perpetuity in order for black students to be admitted to colleges. They will never, ever be admitted on merit as long as we allow the schools to continue doing what they're doing.
Okay, Dr. Jennifer, would you respond to that?
I don't agree with that at all. I think the point that is being made here is that there are instances where young people have been admitted to college, and surely in many cases, or cases that he is perhaps very familiar with, there are some circumstances in which they have not, they should not have been, and they have not performed well. But I think to take that and to expand it to say, therefore, we should not admit minority students who do not have project at the time of admittance the same kind of credentials that white Americans do, would say that we're going to have a segregated society forever. What in fact occurs is that we have a society in which a variety of young people who happen to be black and Hispanic find themselves trapped in ghettos for reasons beyond their control. Those school systems we know well are not doing a very good job in educating many of these youngsters. Many of these youngsters have the potential for greatness. And all we say is that when these youngsters are ready to come to college, that we use other than SATs to try to evaluate their merit. If these youngsters have the potential to benefit, and we have programs that will get them through, then we should have those programs in existence.
Okay, I think if
when we do that, you have outcomes such as UC Berkeley, and it happens in many other places, where 70% of the black students do not graduate from Berkeley, California. I mean, this is horrible. And what's worse about Berkeley and other colleges is that those students, those black students who go to Berkeley, their SAT scores are 954 average, slightly higher than the national norm. And these students who could be successes at San Jose State College, where their SAT is more like the rest of the college, they could be successes there. But because someone has an image of what the racial composition of Berkeley should be, these students you create artificial failures out of these students. That's one of the great tragedies of the affirmative action program, is that we take students who might be successes elsewhere and we make them into failures. And,
okay.
And see, one of the problems is that the black students at UC Berkeley, their SAT scores are 954, but however, most of the other students are 1300. There's a mismatch as a result of affirmative action.
Okay, if you don't mind, Professor Williams, if I could call you Walter and Dr. Jennifer, if I could call you Frank, if you don't mind,
that'd be fine.
I'd make it easier for me to get back and forth. That is an issue I think the two of you are going to agree to disagree on. Is that basically right, Frank?
Well, I think in a way, but let me just say, because it would be unfortunate if we have information that is wrong. The average student who goes to college, whether that student is white or black, we're only graduating approximately 50% of them in some of the very good schools, some of which he's already named. So the fact that minority students are not graduating at that same rate should not impair them. It's just the fact of life in collegiate education today. It's tough. But what we should be looking at is not so much who we admit and what the qualities of those students, but who exits. There'll be a variety of schools, a cafeteria of opportunities for students, and quality and institutions, community colleges, and state colleges. And I think each institution should make its own mark on society,
okay,
and then use a set of criteria to decide who will be a part of that
Thank
constituency.
Thank you, Walter, very quickly.
And you notice that nobody in this debate, except me, is focusing on the horrendous things that the public schools are doing to those kids that make them so dependent on these special preferential treatment. And that is the tragedy. Millions of black kids are being destroyed because we're worrying about what colleges are doing and ignoring what elementary and secondary schools are doing.
Well, as a matter of fact, you said to me, Walter, on a previous program about 4 or 5 years ago, that if you were the Ku Klux Klan, you could not have done anything worse for black kids than the public school system. Do you still feel that way?
That's right. I've said that if I were the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan and I wanted to destroy any chance for widespread black academic excellence, I could not think of a better way than the public school system in most of our cities.
Okay, thank you. I want to bring in now the other two guests that we have here in the studio. First in the middle is Hattie Hill Storks, and Hattie Hill Storks is the CEO of International Productivity Institute in Dallas. It's an international company which specializes in education and consulting on issues of diversity, team building, leadership, and customer service. Hattie, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dennis. Good to be here.
Now, Hattie, you and I have known each other a long time. You've never heard anybody argue about these issues before, I'm sure, have you?
That's how I spend lots of my days.
Sure. How has this issue affected you? And you're spending your time with corporate America trying to cut through these issues. Tell us First of all, is diversity, which you talk a lot about, and affirmative action, are those the same things, or should we draw a line here and a difference in those two?
We have to draw a line here because the whole concept of diversity is inclusion of all employees in the workplace. And because of the affirmative action issues, people are literally being affected and assuming that when you talk about diversity, you're talking about black-white issues. And if we can get people to understand that with today's downsizing in the business world, that we have to be profit-driven with the changing people in the workplace, the changing labor pool that we have to work with, it takes all of us to be successful. And so in order to do that, you literally have to get people pulling together. And a lot of the affirmative action issues are pulling people apart.
Well, and the thing that you and I were talking before the program, mm-hmm. In fact, I was talking to all of you before the program, and I said to you something that maybe the viewers may find interesting too, because it was interesting to us. As our staff put together the panel and the audience here, we called a lot of people who are top executives in companies, HR mm-hmm. executives in companies. And they said to us, they said, Dennis, and they said to the rest of our staff, we're afraid to come. We're afraid to talk about this issue. We're afraid we'll be sued. I said, well, just come and sit and look around like these folks. Come and sit and look around. And they said, we're afraid to be seen on television because of this issue. I mean, that scares me to death, Hattie, just thinking about it.
Absolutely, and that's exactly what's happened. We're pulling people apart, fighting over something that we're not going to solve, and it's also pulling our businesses apart. And a concern that we have, when you talk about customer service, for instance, I'm not approaching this process as a black woman if I'm buying something. I'm approaching it as a customer, and I want the same type of service, no matter who I am, that anyone is getting. And we have to be really clear that whether I'm a woman, I'm a person of color, whether I'm 65, doesn't matter. The issue is I need the service. I want to exchange my business just like anyone else. And so the issues sometimes tend to pull us apart. I find that true for women. I find it true in the business world for just any major business in the country now is having to address these issues because we're all exposed to the issue of affirmative action.
Next to Hattie is Susie Marshall. I want to bring her in. Susie's a CPA. She's also president and owner of CompuTactics, a firm specializing in helping businesses select appropriate software and hardware. She is the state co-chair of the Texas delegation to the White House Conference on Small Business and has served as treasurer of the National Association of Women Business Owners. Susie, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Dennis.
Now, Susie, you were here in Dallas a couple of weeks ago when the head of NABO, which is the National Association of Women Business Owners, was here. You still have some real concerns as to what would happen if affirmative action went away. Tell us about those.
That's correct. We believe that affirmative action is about promoting diversity positively. We feel that it's very important to keep affirmative action, the parts of it that are about equal opportunity, that what's happened is the pendulum has swung too far. It started out, I think, in 64, trying to remedy discrimination to a point where it became equal. What's happened is it's gone too far the other way. The preferences and the quotas is not what the women business owners feel like is best for business in general. We want to take it back to
middle position.
Would
you say that women have benefited by preferences and quotas?
Yes, women have benefited as a part of affirmative action. But the problem is that affirmative action has gone too far with its preferences, and so coming back to middle is what we would want to see happen, and we want to promote equal opportunity for all businesses, all women of ethnic backgrounds and minorities as well. It seems that it's critical to the U.S. economy that the talents of all people are utilized, and right now the talents of women and of all backgrounds and minorities as well are grossly underutilized.
Right. Well, in fact, you've even had discrimination, women against women. Have you not?
Absolutely.
Hattie, tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely, Dennis. One of the biggest concerns that I think we have in this country right now is although women in this country have such a small piece of the pie, we then tend to divide because clearly if you look at the numbers, white women have made a lot more progress than women of color, but the pie is still small for white women. So when you start looking at the progress that we've made, there's still, you know, if you take it and say we're dividing up 20% of the pie, there's still 80%. And we're taking that 20 and then dividing it up into tens, or even some numbers I look at where you have a white woman will be 8%, and then women of color will divide it between themselves in twos and ones, and those are the scary numbers.
That's a divisiveness. Frank, please.
One of the things that I'm very concerned about, and that is that I really think to a large degree, the issue is more a wedge issue, more of a political issue than it is reality. For affirmative action has been the law of the land for 35 years. If affirmative action has been, blacks in particular benefited from affirmative action, if that's the argument, then why in the world, after 35 years, we have a program, and the end result is that African Americans, for the most part, in many respects, are further behind than before. If we look at every major aspect of corporate America, whatever the division may be, whether it's transportation, African Americans only represent 2% of the corporate offices. If you look at each and every one, after 35 years, we still are up against the so-called glass ceiling. If you look at how much African American men make, they made 74% of what white males made 25 years ago. They make 74% of what they make now. There has been no great advantage of affirmative action for African Americans.
You don't think it's worked, and yet you want to continue it.
I think it is a part, it's a critical piece of a major puzzle. And that major puzzle, when it's fixed, is designed to cure a major problem outside to call racism. It is not the sole thing that will solve it. It has benefited a significant portion of Americans, primarily women. It has also benefited upwardly mobile African Americans who've been in business and doing contracts with the federal government. But it has not benefited the vast majority of African Americans. We are still a people in a land in which racism is really, really still having its impact. And to resolve the problems of African Americans and other minorities, race must be a part of the solution.
Okay, so it's a racist mission. I want to go to Walter in Washington. Then I have a gentleman here in the audience, and I'm going to bring our final guest on, who's joining us by phone from L.A. Walter, would you respond to what you just heard?
Well, that's part of the bait and switch of affirmative action. That is, that when supporters talk about affirmative action, the necessity for these programs, they parade poor, unfortunate blacks across the stage. And once they get the program in, it is the elite among the blacks who are the beneficiaries. This is a despicable form of bait and switch. But there's even very despicable forms of affirmative action in New York City today. In order for a white patrolman to be promoted to a sergeant, he must score 70 on the exam. In order for a Hispanic, he has to become a sergeant, he has a score of 67, and for a black, it's 65. That is despicable and offensive to every standard of decency that people want to hold, and it's very widespread. Now, when Frank said that we need affirmative action for upward mobility, I don't believe that's true. You know, at one time, black Americans were not allowed to be professional basketball players. Today, there are 80% of professional basketball players. At one time, blacks were not allowed to be professional football players. Today, they're close to 60%. Can you explain the dominance of blacks on the basketball court in professional basketball by affirmative action or quotas? No, you can't. You can explain it in the following fashion. That is, those guys can do a 360 slam dunk in your face and you can't stop them. It is excellence. Now, if you had that kind of talent in physics or chemistry, Lawrence Livermore Radiation Laboratories would be full of black nuclear physicists. And that's what we need to focus on, developing excellence in these other areas, and so that people can compete on their merit and also in a moral fashion.
Okay, thank you, Walter. I'm going to ask a gentleman here. This is Tim Hoyp. Tim, you, first of all, tell us exactly what your position is with the HR Association, and tell us about some of the surveys that you've taken and how people, at least in this part of the country, view affirmative action.
Well, I'm president of the Dallas Human Resource Management Association, which is an organization of over 1,400 HR professionals here in the Dallas area, representing probably some 750 different employers. We did a recent survey amongst our membership at one of our meetings regarding the whole affirmative action question. And the issue of whether the group felt it outlived its usefulness, the group in general did not believe so. I think the most employers are against quotas. They're against special preference per se, but I think there's a general belief that there are some aspects of affirmative action that have been very beneficial, and we ought to not throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Mm-hmm. But you could see that there could be some changes to it that might be in everyone's best interest, possibly.
Very much so. And I think one of the things that Hattie speaks to is the issue of diversity. And our national organization, the Society of Human Resource Management, is very much interested in bringing forth that issue that we have to understand the multicultural nature of the workforce in order to better improve the productivity and the effectiveness of workers in general.
Well, that's good business, whether we have affirmative action laws or not. I think everyone would agree with that. I'm going to bring in the last person who is joining us by phone from L.A., and his name is Joel Kotkin. And Joel Kotkin not only lives in L.A., works in L.A., he's a frequent contributor to the L.A. Times, the Wall Street Journal, and Reason Magazine. And he's the author of Tribes, How Race, Religion, and Identity Determine Success in the New Global Economy. Joel, can you hear me?
I can hear you fine.
Okay, let me ask you to give us just a bit of historical perspective here. I mean, you've heard the arguments, you've heard a lot of things talked about as affirmative action. You wrote an article for the Wall Street Journal, which I read a couple of weeks ago, which is the reason I contacted you. And in that article, you talked about what Hubert Humphrey said when the original Civil Rights Act was passed back in, I think, 1964. Give us some historical perspective on what the law was designed to do when it was first passed.
Well, the law was designed to prevent discrimination. It had nothing in it about quotas, and Senator Humphrey, who I think was one of the great American political leaders of the second half of the century, made it very, very clear that that was not what he was talking about, as did Martin Luther King and others. Affirmative action grew in part out of an attempt to deal, what we know of as affirmative action now, to deal with some situations, for instance, in Philadelphia and some other major cities where craft unions, for instance, were clearly discriminating against, and that was something that was covered in the 64 Act. Over time, through judges, through federal orders, it evolved into a series of other things, which essentially are quotas, or preferences at best, based on race. And of course, what's happened historically, and this is one of the reasons why it's come to a head, I think, here in California first, is actually, it may be surprising to your audience to know that only about 7% of the population of California is African-American, about 12% of the population of Los Angeles. So what's happened is, but in California, we have now extended it not only to women, but it's been tried to be used for to a more limited extent, but it's being used for Latinos and for Asian Americans and even for some other groups in certain places, to the point that it has now become so unwieldy that it does very little good for anybody in real terms, except for a small, and I think Professor Williams is right about this, a small group who essentially use it to supercharge their careers to get advantages over other people. Now, the fact of the matter is, and this was the point of my article in the Wall Street Journal, the real issue, the real crisis in American civilization today is not whether Latino or Asian or feminine middle-class people advance quicker. Yes, they shouldn't be discriminated against, and yes, it would be nice to have them advance quicker, but the real problem in America is a class problem, a problem of what we would call here either gangbangers or the vatos locos, the people who are not even participating in the system. And I think the focus on affirmative action and on what I think is largely tokenism doesn't deal with the real fundamental moral and economic problems that are the real threat to this country, and not this issue, which I think is an issue which really only divides and also, by the way, serves the purposes of the Newt Gingriches and other people who maybe don't really want to deal with the fundamental economic issues.
Now, just hang with us, if you don't mind. We're going to come back to that issue of the underclass in a bit. I want to first go to someone here who is sitting in the audience. Who we have, I think, probably more than one attorney here, but certainly this one. And you've heard what's been said so far. How did we get from where Joel Kotkin was telling us this act that was not to discriminate to where we are today? And tell us some of the legal things that have happened, maybe some of the court decisions that he talked about that have gotten us to where we are today.
Sure. Well, the act was initially brought forth to remedy discrimination in this country. In fact, some of the initial legislative history, they talk about trying to remedy the plight of the Negro in American economy. So that was one of the reasons that the law was passed. And we can have affirmative action in many different forms. In its most basic form, you could say that it's requiring that a company have an equal employment opportunity policy stated when they advertise for workers. And it can go further than that in terms of preferences for training programs, and then go to the other extreme, which is absolute quotas. And you have basically three types of affirmative action plans in place in America. The first one is a court-ordered plan that is put into place by a court to remedy past discrimination from an employer. A second one is government-imposed quotas that are pursuant to Executive Order 11246, which is if you do business with a government, then you have to live up to their requirements. And there are smaller requirements for smaller companies, larger contracts, they actually have percentage quotas. And the third one is voluntary plans, where a company will determine that they've had some problems in hiring or that they want diversity in their workforce, and they will voluntarily identify through self-analysis a plan and put a reasonable plan in place.
Okay. So you have different ways of going about it, all the way from the thing that I doubt most people would object to, which is we have a policy that says we're not going to discriminate. I mean, that's something that people, I think most everybody can sign on to. I think Walter Williams would probably agree with that too. Wouldn't you, Walter?
I surely would.
Okay. So I just want to make sure. So now, from that, however, we've got a situation in which people are, as I mentioned earlier, afraid to come on this program, afraid to talk about this issue. Give us a couple of examples of legal actions that might make people afraid to do just that.
Sure. Well, everyone, the business people that I talk to, are afraid of reverse discrimination suits. I think the statistics show that that's fairly rare. In fact, a recent study that a Rutgers professor did indicated that of the opinions from 1990 to 1994, only about 3 or 4% involved race discrimination, reverse discrimination type cases. However, having said that, there is a fear that when those cases go to a jury, the jurors become angry. And in fact, in Dallas, last part of January of this year, two white employees sued Ashland Chemical Corporation, and they were fired, and they alleged, because the company wanted to curry favors with black and Hispanic leaders in that workforce and promoted them to their jobs, and they got a $2.2 million verdict here in Dallas. So that causes companies concern. They want a safe harbor. One of the ways they can do that is through the EEOC, which does have a program that you can have a affirmative action plan put together and approved by them, and that does give you some safe harbor.
Good. Or you can hire Hattie to come do these things, pay all these great fees, right?
One of the things that I think is a real problem is the language that we use and the definitions that we use. For example, when we talk about affirmative action and you ask the average American, especially white males, and white males in this country feel very strongly that they're losing their jobs, they're losing income, they're losing the kind of employment they have historically had to lift themselves up by their bootstraps. They believe that they are being beat out from these jobs, and the reasons they're not getting jobs and that they're underemployed is that there's some quota system operative in America that women and minorities are replacing them. The reality, absolutely not. There is not one statistic that anyone can bring forward on a population basis that shows that that's the case.
Well, now, I have a study. I can't tell you which one it was.
Well, let's talk about the most.
It clearly says one out of ten white males has been discriminated against. I don't know if that's an accurate study, but 1 out of 10.
But the best study and the most recent study was a study that has been recently conducted by a commission called the Glass Ceiling Commission. Okay. Let me first say, that study was initiated by Mrs. Dole, and then it was legislation put in by her husband, Dole, when he was the minority leader. That legislation led to a study. The report has recently been released. The best study conducted to date. If you look at that study by every indice, it shows that affirmative action has not been the great benefactor that it should, that people think it has been for minorities. It has been very good for women, but not for minorities. What it does show, however, is that it shows that there's an awful lot of racism and there's an awful lot of sexism that exists in America today. That study was by 10 Republicans and 10 Democrats. It was created by a Republican, and it has shown very definitively that in corporate America and in public in general, racism is alive and well, and affirmative action has not been the cure.
Okay,
it's just been a small dose of good, hard treatment.
Okay, let me go to Walter.
Frank,
Walter, and then Hattie.
No, I just asked Frank. Those 2,000 white and Asian students who are turned away from Berkeley University in order to make room for blacks and Hispanics, would you say that that was fair treatment of them, and would you say that they were harmed by affirmative action?
Let me explain. I would say that that was not fair treatment, but let me explain how that happens. If we were to take 19,000 students that applied to Berkeley It is crazy to believe that you can rank those 19,000 by some score from 1 to 19,000. You would find that a group of qualified people cluster around a certain number. Once you get that clustering of a population of people, all who have equal qualifications for admission, and you still don't have enough room, you are allowed by law and logic to begin to use other criteria for admissions of those.
Well, the, as,
you can look
just
at the
like
part
you
of
use,
the country
you
that
you
they come
color.
From. You can look at the major that they are offering. You can look at their gender. You can look at their race. That was the essence in the Bakke case.
And that's part, that that's case part of the problem. Standard. That is
that's
part of the problem.
Part of the problem. That's part of the solution.
Okay, go ahead, Walter. Come.
That's part of the problem. And then also, when the gentleman was talking about, I forget his name, he was talking about how employers have been intimidated by affirmative action. It even works to the disadvantages of blacks. For example, you take a black student who graduates from law school and a white student who graduates from law school, and they go to a law firm to work. Now, the partners at the law firm, if the white student makes a mistake, they will read him the Riot Act. But because of fear of charges of discrimination, they may go easy on the black guy. Okay. Now, what it turns out over the years is that the black guy does not get the kind of training that the white guy would get because the employers are afraid of him.
Walter, that's a tragedy. Walter, let me tag on to that question. One of the things that in our research that people have asked us many times, and I think because I think the issue of racism that Frank brings up is very true. What do the people who perceive themselves as having been discriminated against because they are white or because what? I mean, how do they feel? And does that increase their feelings of anger toward black people or females, or does it make them feel better toward them?
Well, if I had it my way, if I were trying to organize whites, recruit whites into the Ku Klux Klan, I couldn't think of better programs than many of these programs that go on in college. For example, at Penn State University, all black students who score have a C grade point and higher, they stopped it quite recently because it was exposed to the light of day, were getting $500 and $1,000 bonuses. Now, can you imagine the resentment of a white student from a poor family in Appalachia coming down there to see that kind of stuff? Well, and there are all these kind of programs that result in racial resentment. Matter of fact, at colleges, particularly colleges that have strong affirmative action programs, there's more racial resentment, more racial conflicts in colleges in Massachusetts than the entire South, because these colleges in Massachusetts have widespread affirmative action programs, and they create resentment, and on top of that, they don't help the black
students. Can I maybe speak to that? Since I was chancellor of higher education for the state of Massachusetts,
please do.
I think I probably know a little bit about what's going on in that state.
Okay, tell us what's happening in Massachusetts.
First, let me just say that the idea that somehow or another there is a massive admissions of unqualified black students in the colleges and universities is absurd. I'm the president of the University of Texas at Dallas now. My institution has 5% black students. Those 5% black students have SAT scores averaging around 1,000. That's higher than most of the students, white or female or anything else, that attend schools throughout this entire nation. Those students don't come in through two doors and go out and perform worse. They come out and perform better. They help our school and they help America by creating a diverse workforce, a diverse country, so that we can benefit in a diverse world in which we compete in.
Hello?
Everybody recognizes that is the case, except the very few who'd like to use affirmative action as a wedge issue, as an issue that perhaps those individuals who happen to be white and find themselves out of jobs will not deal with the real fundamental problem, and that is that they are getting poor while the rich get richer, but they blame even poorer people than them for their problems.
Okay.
We need to understand that,
Whoa.
And we need to talk about
okay.
it, rather than to have individuals bring up rhetoric that has no fact,
You guys make great cases. Hattie is sitting here just chomping at the bit. Now I'm going to go to Joel Kotkin again. Hattie, please.
I was going to say, you sit here and you listen, and we can go back and forth on this all day long, but for Walter specifically, I see this whole concept as an economic issue. And I'm just real clear that an SAT score, for instance, I could have done well on an SAT score if my mom and had the money to send me to be coached so that when I go in to actually take the test and I could do better and reach that average. What we have to look at is how economically we are affected in this country around all of these issues. If I do well economically in this country, then I'm going to have the money to reach back into a black neighborhood and help young black children. And if their parents can't afford or whomever's there with that child can't afford to help them, then I can help them and go into that community. And the issues that are really facing us, when you start looking at young people, I started working with particular young girl from the Dallas Independent School District about 6 years ago, and the issues that they were dealing with when they get home at night, something as simple as, I can't read my work because I have to read by flashlight, because if we have our lights on, we have gang violence. Those are real issues. But it's an economic issue, and the more people move into organizations and have positions and start businesses, women and people of color, then you're able to affect those systems so that the person that I would send to Walter, to Dr. Jennifer, yes, they would be able to do much better in this society.
Okay, thanks.
Well, Hattie, you know,
let me go to Joel Kotkin.
Okay.
Joel Kotkin, please.
Yeah, you just said one of my least favorite phrases, which is people of color, because it's, to me, unbelievable to say that 90% of the world that isn't white is sort of a group that shares something, you know, so in common. One of the things that's very interesting, we have to look at definitions. The words minorities are used over and over again. We have about 10% of our population, larger than our black population, is Asian. Asians, although even those who are doing, who come here, who are poor, and even are on welfare, outperform every other ethnic group in the state academically, are actually in many ways some of the greatest victims of reverse discrimination. And they are obviously of a different race, which has historically been the target of more racial discrimination in the state of California than any other. So the issue of simply that racism is the problem, or the issue that that all so-called people of color, which is something that I think exists among maybe human resource professionals and academics, but the reality is that in the real world, most of, for instance, a very large minority group, and there are others that are also minority groups like Cubans who are doing reasonably well. So I think one of the things is I don't think the problem, although racism is a problem, I don't think it is the fundamental problem. The fundamental problem is a moral problem, is an economic problem, and a strategy problem. And this is where I think affirmative action is very dangerous.
Thanks.
The thing that's really wrong about the whole question of affirmative action is it's all focused on what we can get from large institutions from outside our community. In my book, Tribes, and in all the research I've done on ethnic groups, those who do best are those who, yes, they should fight to make sure that they have equal treatment and have a remedy, but are those who start their own business, sell to each other, develop their own, work with their own children, and they, by the way, they can be poor. There is not a direct correlation between income and school scores if you look at, for instance, immigrant populations. And it is the ethos of self-help and the ethos of taking care of your own that is more important. And the African-American community had a tremendous history of doing this in the past, and I think that if the movement was more in that direction, there is a large black middle class. Maybe if they were putting their efforts into helping the poorer people in their community instead of concentrating on an issue like affirmative action, I think the results would be infinitely better.
Okay, thank you very much. I have a comment here from the audience. Let me get to him first.
I want to redirect this conversation a little bit toward the problems I have experienced in the corporate world. I've worked for, in the past, three major multinational corporations that everyone recognized the names. Each one of them, during the interview process, said, come to work for us, we'll take care of you. And I think that's maybe the major problem that we have in our society today, that we all have kind of slipped into this, I don't want to take care of myself, I let somebody else take care of me, be it the employer, the government, or whoever. As a result, that has developed a situation where, because the employer has complete control of our career, then their discrimination is very devastating to us. What we've seen with these old-style corporations laying off literally millions of Americans is a new group of maverick companies exploding, which you're probably familiar with, that are rewarding people based purely on merit. And let me explain one thing about the last multinational corporation I worked for. Despite of years of affirmative action, there wasn't one black engineer I ever met. Not one out of the thousands. So if we want to evaluate affirmative action on whether it's worked or not, it's been a dismal failure if you couldn't find one black engineer out of 1,000. But when you take a look at some of these new maverick corporations, then you find that the percentage of the population of the top people in those companies is roughly the same as that of the general population.
Okay. Susie, you're involved with maverick corporations, smaller corporations, but people that are very active. Let me talk about one thing we haven't talked about yet, and that's the idea of government set-asides. I know a lot of National Association of Women Business Owners try to get jobs from the government, and how do you cut through all that maze? Is it possible to do that, and does affirmative action in one of its forms help you?
Well, I think women have benefited from affirmative action programs, but I think that a company should compete for jobs and contracts fairly across the board. So I don't think that having a certain set aside for a group is exactly the way that it ought to be. However, I will tell you that our Texas delegation has recommended that there be set asides for small business in general, not just for minorities or women-owned
companies.
So, but
you think small business needs a set aside, but not necessarily female or black set asides?
Yes, I think so. I think that small business would be helped by that. At least our delegation feels that way. But I'd like to add one more thing, if I could.
Sure.
And that's to comment on the glass ceiling report. Whereas I think women have benefited to some degree, there's only 3 to 5% of the women that occupy senior management positions. So whereas women may have gotten someplace, they're not very far. That platform of who's going to be the next CEOs is just not there.
Well, the numbers.
And one more thing, if I could ask one more thing, with the federal dollars, and that is that in the federal contracts, 93% last year, 1994, 93% of the federal contract dollars went to companies owned by white males. Women own over 30% of the business.
Is that 93% of the dollars or 93% of the contract numbers?
Yes.
Dollars.
Yes.
Okay. Now, women own how many
women
businesses?
Own over 30% of businesses, and they got 1.9%.
Okay, let me ask you this question, though.
Less than two.
Aren't most women-owned businesses, we've done programs on this, which is why, wouldn't you agree that most women-owned businesses have less than 5 employees.
Yes,
so they couldn't handle the large businesses anyway. I just want to make that point.
But many can. But let me just say, minorities though have 10% of the business, and they got 4.9%. So 7% we're talking about is all that went to minority and women-owned companies.
Okay, thanks.
If not affirmative action, then what? What will take its place? Because it's evident in today's society that discrimination still exists. Look at corporate America. Look at the boardrooms across corporate America. They are not representative of the minorities or women and ethnic backgrounds. It's still predominantly white male. And I want to just read from a couple of statistics here real quickly. A 1993 study by the Hispanic Association of Corporate Responsibility found that less than 1% of the top managers in a Fortune 500 companies were Latinos. And also the other study is a Fair Employment Council of Washington, D.C. sent out pairs of identically qualified Anglos and Latinos to test discrimination hiring in 1992, and they found that that equally qualified Latino applicants were turned down in favor of their white counterparts for more than one job out of every 5 in every type of job, and similar studies have been conducted in Chicago and San Diego with similar results. So if we're not talking that affirmative action is not working, we need something in its place. So then what is the solution?
Thank you very much. Let's do a focus for the time we have left here on what should we do. Frank, please.
I'm going to do that, but I can't resist it
mention
one point. And that is that it's very unfortunate that we continue to talk about racism as though we're talking about a 1953 style racism. We're talking about an institutional form of racism now where there are no overt racists, but what we have in effect is a variety of people who would like to do business as usual. That is old, going back to the old boys network of picking those companies and friends to work for you, who you know, who play golf, who look like you, who act like you. That is a common behavior of human beings. What affirmative action attempts to do is to break that down and say you cannot go back to those old networks. What you have to do is that you have to affirmatively go out, seek individuals who are qualified, and from that qualified pool of individuals, we would expect, based on some numerical and some statistical analysis, that that qualified pool should represent a certain number of minority. Bring those people forward. That is the essence of affirmative action,
saying,
and properly done
that
would not be the debate.
We ought to broaden that network. The network's not bad, but the network's not inclusive enough.
Is
that what
first,
you're saying?
Well, in its pure essence, the only time one has ever used quotas, or quotas are legitimate, capable of being used, is when there is an egregious form of proven racism that has occurred. Under those circumstances, the court can impose quotas. Other than that, quotas are circumstances that are in the figment of the minds of those individuals who would like to use it as a way to put the poor white against the poor black, and while the rich get richer by 9% each year, the poor get poorer by 5%. My friends, that is basically the issue in America, and if we don't face up to it and continue to allow people to use to define our words, to define our vocabulary, we will have blacks and whites fighting each other when, in fact, I think we agree on so very, very much.
I tell you what, we're going to do a program exactly on that, I can promise you. But before I get to Hattie,
I need the whole hour
and
her, hour,
so, I know, we need the whole hour for that. But I want to ask you, you said in Linda Chavez, who is with the, I forget what her institute is
Manhattan
in
Institute.
Washington. What is it, Walter?
It's the Manhattan Institute.
Manhattan Institute. Wrote a piece for the USA Today recently. And Frank, I saw your blip beside it. And basically you said if we do away with affirmative action, they'll be held to pay. Do you think that people who are presently benefiting or think they're benefiting from affirmative action will be in the streets if we do away with it?
What we have in America is something that we have never seen before. We have a population of Americans living amongst us who, for the first time in the history of our society, do not have hope. They believe that their circumstances are permanent. They do not live by our laws. They do not live by our behavior. They believe that the only hope for them is to create a third kind of an economy that's operative. If we, again, continue to close the doors on these people, do not create educational programs that allow them to be inclusive, do not include work programs that allow them to become a part of the main economic structure, they have no alternative but to strike out. Those individuals are growing larger each and every year in their numbers. We're getting smaller each and every year in our numbers. I would not want to live in a society that has that kind of a mix.
You're nervous and you're making me nervous. Let me go to this comment and then to you, Hattie.
My feeling is that we've got to quit color-coding our society and become a color society, and I agree with you, Hattie. One of the best solutions is education. It's an economic issue and a moral issue, but we need to educate people and quit dumbing down and let everybody get an equal education and play on a level field.
Hattie, I would agree with that. I think back to Brenda's question is, what's the solution? I think we've got to go back to the drawing board. You can't throw it totally out, as Dr. Jennifer said, but you also have to do three things. And the first has to be education. We have got to get people to understand what these issues really are, that this is not about pulling us apart in the worlds that we live in, but pulling us together. Because if my neighbor is black, white, Hispanic, I don't care. If someone's breaking in their house, they may get into my house next. The second issue has to be exposure. We do not have exposure to each other as people. Need to get to know each other. There's an assumption out there that all black people, for instance, think alike. That when you see a survey in the media that says, you know, all black people think O.J. Simpson is innocent, and people really believe that stuff. So we have to expose people to people who are truly different from us. And then finally is economics, that we all benefit when we can all come to the table.
Thank you. We're about to lose our satellite time. So Walter, I'm going to give you, give me a minute or so. And what should we do in your estimation?
Well, I think that the first thing we should recognize is that the civil rights struggle in America is over and it's won. That is, at one time, black Americans did not have the constitutional guarantees as everybody else. Now we do. Now, the fact that the civil rights struggle is over and won does not mean that they're not major problems, but they're not civil rights problems. That is, the 67% illegitimacy rate among blacks, that's a devastating problem, but it's not a civil rights problem. The fraudulent education, the family breakdown among blacks, they are devastating problems, but they're not civil rights problems, and they will not be problems that will be solved through civil rights strategy. We have to, this is the great danger of this, of the affirmative action mentality, is that we're directing resources into an area where the payoff is not very high.
Apparently, we just lost Walter. So, Walter, thank you very much for being with us. Let me go to Joel Kotkin. Joel, please, what can we do?
I think the basic issue, I think Walter was pointing out, and I think is really, when you think about it, is we must deal with the problem of the underclass in this country, and that affirmative action is not the way. It doesn't even touch that population, and we have to look at how we can bring a better education and better economic opportunities to inner city neighborhoods. Excuse me?
I think we still have a satellite feed. Go ahead. Just go ahead.
So the bottom line is, I think that we have to focus on the fundamental economic and social issues and not on the civil rights strategies, because I think they are counterproductive. There's a good group of people, human resource professionals, people in academia, people in middle management of corporations. There's a whole group of people who have a class interest in the present preference system, but it does not deal with the issue that keeps people awake at night in this country, and that is a problem of the underclass. It doesn't even begin to touch them. Believe me, the gangbangers in Vatos Locos don't care about whether or not black or Latino professionals or professors get jobs at a somewhat more elevated pace. It doesn't matter. It isn't facing the real issue. And the way we have to understand the problems of the 60s were different than the problems of the 90s, and we have to start focusing on the real problem.
Joel, thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciate you being
with
us.
Thank you.
Walter, I think you're still there. If so, give us about 15 seconds of wrap-up from your standpoint as to what we should
do. I think Joel is absolutely right. We need to focus on these substantive issues. They're hard issues, and they will not be solved by government.
Thank you, Walter, from just outside the Beltway in Washington, D.C. Yeah, you're going to round of applause for that. Susie, from a business owner's standpoint, how can we make it better for the people that we hire, the people we work with, the people we sell to? What should we do to get out of what is apparently not working?
Well, I think that people do business with people they trust. We have to learn how to trust, how to learn about people of different races and different sexes. And information is the key for that. Education and information is the way that we learn how to trust.
Hattie, you talk to people about this all the time. The people watching this program, what specifically could they do tomorrow that would help this issue in your estimation?
Continue to educate themselves. We must develop strategic alliances among ourselves so that we can tackle these problems from top down and from bottom down, or from top up and bottom down.
Frank, I'm going to volunteer the people who are watching this thing in Texas to come see you. Would that be okay with
no,
you?
No, thank you.
Oh, no. I can't believe
what
it.
What I would suggest is that I think what we perhaps have heard from some of us is that America is a great country. And it's a great country because of the mix of people that we have, because we are a diverse country. What we have to begin to do is not to allow people to use wedge issues to separate us. There's so much we have in common. We need to work on those commonalities. But at the same time that we benefit from this great country, we also have a responsibility to ensure that those who are born in circumstances that are beyond their control, who are not able to take advantage of it, that we give them a helping hand as we climb the ladder of success.
We're gonna focus.
That's what affirmative action attempts to do, and that's what we need to work on, but we also need to expand it to deal with the growing problems of economic injustice.
We're gonna focus on those issues. I wanna thank Walter Williams from the D.C. area, Joel Kotkin from the other coast in L.A., and obviously the three of you and our wonderful audience. And obviously I want to thank you, because in the next few years, this issue may well define the continuing racial struggle here in America. Does it help those who truly need help? Does it cause more harm than good? Or does it merely address the wrong issues? Now, these are questions for you to decide. Think through these questions carefully, and then let your views be heard. But most importantly, continue to look at yourself in an attempt to be personally as objective as you can in your dealing with others. Thanks for inviting us in to talk about things that really matter with people who care.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.